The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. I'm Kurt Benrud. This is titled Notes on the Game in Progress, Played Almost to a Draw, by Alex Schwartzman. It was a great match, until the other side cheated. The planet was perfect for the championship game, lush with biomass, dominated by a single intelligent species spread far and wide across its surface. Both teams gleefully studied the natives' history and preparations. We opened in Mesopotamia. At Babel, various peoples were conditioned to speak different tongues. Unable to understand one another, the natives steeled their hearts against the other tribes. As ever, war drove progress. The Arcturians had conserved their points and let things develop all the way through the Middle Ages. Then they had introduced the bubonic plague into the yurts of the Mongols. Genghis Khan died in obscurity as a young man. It was a subtle but effective move. Without the rise of the Golden Horde, there was also no Renaissance, and Europe remained in darkness. It would cost too many points to counter effectively, so we chose another play. With their new gunpowder weapons and no threat from the Mongols, the Sultanate of Rum had easily defeated the Crusaders and ushered in a 1,000-year caliphate. The Arcturians tried a few other tricks, but our strategy was solid, and it cost few points to stave them off. Under the generous patronage of the caliphate, mathematics and other sciences flourished as never before. By the 1500s, they had colonized the Americans. By the 1800s, they had developed nuclear fission. In 1915, the desperate leaders of a failed uprising in Australia found that they had nothing left to lose. With caliphate troops on the verge of retaking Canberra, they unleashed the hydrogen missiles. The planet looked even prettier in black and red than it did in blue and white. We won the first round. The Arcturians admitted defeat and hit reset. They adopted a completely different strategy in the second round, spending the bulk of their points on the opening move to go back a million years and introduce bacteria into the ground that slowly and systematically destroyed the planet's oil reserves. It was a brilliant move. We did what we could, but without the fuel for the combustion engine, human technology did not advance quickly enough. Wars were still fought. Great steam airships clashing in the sky and raining poisonous gas on the cities below. But in this round, the atom wasn't split nearly soon enough. By the time they had the technology, humans were already too mature to use it toward destruction. The round ended when the first nuclear-powered spaceship landed on another planet. The score was tied, and the match down to the final game. With few points left to spend, each side made small surgical plays after the reset. The Arcturians poisoned Alexander the Great in his early 30s, collapsing his empire too soon. We countered by arming the Roman senators with sharp blades on the Ides of March. We burned the Library of Alexandria to dampen the human spirit. And they convinced Leopold Mozart to teach his children music in order to uplift it. It was a great game, with us slowly gaining the advantage. In the 20th century, we instigated a pair of world wars and even managed a handful of nuclear detonations. Victory within decades was almost assured. And that's when the Arcturians cheated. Outplayed and almost out of points, they used the military networks we helped create and turned them into something called the Internet. It was pretty much the opposite of the Babel play. Humans from all cultures could now communicate, collaborate, understand each other. how are we to compete with that? We did what we could to forestall their space program and temporarily deny the Arcturians victory. But now we're almost out of points, too, and have to contemplate our next action very, very carefully. It will need to be a phenomenal final move.
Dan Oliver reading The Fallen Girl by Marge Simon. Since her untimely birth in the brothels of Lamora, she was mothered by many, daughter of none. The city spawned more children than the poor could afford. Boys were sent to work the streets, young girls to Lamora. She'd witnessed them be broken in for service. When it came her turn, she was the only one who didn't cry. Her name doesn't matter. She's barely 17, but she looks much older. In the forest surrounding Lamora, there is a glade that she visits when she is depressed. This time, she thinks of suicide, for she's obtained a knife. An evening breeze condensed with messages. Would that she were free to follow the moonlight out of this place. A man approaches from the shadows. His robes are priestly, his demeanor condescending. What are you doing here, little sister? Do you await a customer? I'm quite done with customers, Vicar. I can't go back to that. How about me, little sister? He smirks, loosening his robe. Will you not make an exception on the house? Smiling, she stands up. You are indeed an exception, Vicar, as you've always been, she says, fingering the blade within her pocket. After it is done, she cleans her knife. To her surprise, the moonlight reflecting off the blade reveals a new path she hasn't noticed before. Smiling, she looks up to the sky and nods her head.
I'm Kurt Benrut. This is Vincent's First Bass by Eric M. Witchie. Go ahead, his father said. Stand up. Vince was a Vanderpender ninth grader, and he'd seen flat-bottomed punts in his art history courses. Not that he liked art history, he was a math boy, but he'd seen pictures of men fishing from boats like his dad's. They started rowing before sunrise. Now they floated on glassy water in a back bay of Oleanta Lake in the rolling hill country near the Ohio River. Wisps of steam rose off the water, and a bird someplace made a really spooky cry. At least his father told him it was a bird. A loon, he'd said. Vince wasn't sure if the name was a joke or not. The cry sounded crazy, and he supposed someone might have named a bird that made that sound the loon. It's safe, his father said. He nodded. The boat moved if Vince moved. He could feel it. It was action-reaction, simple Newtonian physics. He should be able to compensate. The variables were known. His weight, height, angle of lean, center of mass, the friction coefficient of the surface area of the bottom of the boat against the lake water. Fish are waiting, his father said. Daylight's a-wastin', and they won't wait forever for us to pluck him out of the lake. His father? Vince barely remembered the man. He was weather-tanned and tall, broad like a weightlifter, but dressed in his olive-green game warden's uniform. He was a myth, a wild country legend that Vince's mother despised. Feet braced wide for a better center of gravity, Vince slipped his blue-jeaned butt forward off the bench of the punt. Knees bent to create springs to absorb movement, he managed to stand. Good, his father sat, hands on oars, making casual micro-movements to steady the boat. It's really just physics, he said. I hear from the school you're really good at that stuff. His father handed him a fishing rod. Vince managed to nod without falling out of the boat. "The reel goes on the bottom," his father said. Open-faced reels hang down below the rod for balance. Vince let the reel drop low. The stem that held the reel to the rod slipped in between his fingers. "Don't worry, son," his father said. He let go of an oar and adjusted his cap. "I'll teach you what you need to know." Vince was sure he looked like a rank beginner. He hated looking like a beginner in front of this man, which was pretty silly since they'd only just met. But his father was a fish and wildlife warden, and for the first time he could remember, he was spending time with his father like other kids. Of course, he'd seen the look in his father's eyes, in the eyes of kids at school, and in the eyes of the other kids' fathers. The look said it all. Vince was a geek. "The rod is a spring," his father said. "Cool," Vince heard the shake in his voice. "A spring," he thought. "Knowable variables. Algebra. Hooke's law. Calculus. No worries." He measured the length and taper with his mind's eye. He bounced the tip to test material tensioning against the weight of the bulbous gold and fluorescent orange lure at the rod tip. "Let a little line out," his father said. He bounced the tip again. The bright lure bounced. The silver, oval plate spinning on its side, tinkled and flashed in the morning sun. No line came out. He tried to pull the line out. "No," his father said. "Throw the bail, son." "The what?" "The wire around the edge of the spool." Vince nodded. "Oh." There was a rigid chrome wire around the edge of the reel. The line left the spool and slipped under a little guide on that wire. "Do I throw the whole rod?" His father laughed at him. Not good. Hot embarrassment burned his face. He should have said no when the lawyer came to Vanderpinder for him. It was a moment of decision. He had created the wrong universe with his decision. He should have picked the universe in which he went to the chess tournament in New Mexico. But some other Vince was in that universe now. "Sorry," his father said. "You'll learn. Try to relax. Hold the rod in your right hand and lift the bail away from the face of the reel until it clicks." He listened. He did exactly what he'd been told. The bail clicked open and the lure dropped like the lead weight it mostly was. It hit the bottom of the punt and made a metallic clank. Vince wanted to melt away and hide from the steady eyes of his father. "Sorry," he said. "No need," his father said. "That's supposed to happen." "Really?" "Yep." He searched the tanned lines of his father's face for signs of suppressed ridicule or judgment. All he saw was joy and confidence. His game warden dad said, "Now crank the handle with your left hand." He did. The bail snapped back over the reel face and picked up the line. The spool turned and the lure lifted from the bottom of the boat. "Stop," his father said. Vince did. The lure hung a foot or so off the rod tip. Vince started to feel a little confidence. He thought he was getting it. A counterweighted lever, reel underslung, fulcrum at his wrist, tapered fiberglass spring, 18 inches of 8-pound test monofilament with plus or minus 3% elasticity, and a 2-ounce weight dangling like a pendulum. Manageable variables. The boat rocked. Vince almost lost his balance. It was a lot to keep track of. Rod, reel, line, boat, balance. The equations danced in his head, but he managed to keep the numbers clean and ordered. "It's okay," his father said. "My fault. We were drifting near a submerged stump." "Would we crash?" Vince asked. "And sink?" His father laughed again. The laugh echoed off the Ohio hills. The weird bird trilled its eerie response. "Bump and maybe rock," his father said. "Even if we had a hole the size of a basketball in the bottom, the boat would float. The seats are filled with buoyant foam." "Do I cast now?" Vince had once seen a guy cast while clicking through YouTube channels. The title of the video had been Surface Tension, and Vince had thought the video was about molecular cohesion. Instead, it was about a man who went fishing after a fight with his wife. "Yeah," his father said. There's big bass in these stumps. With a little luck, you'll pick one up. He swung the rod tip back and let the pendulum weight ride its arc. He felt the rod spring load. He calculated the rate of load and the point of maximum arc. He pushed the rod forward to increase the loading. He snapped his arm forward and let the rod tip unload. The weighted lure came forward, swung fast around the rod tip, and spun in a fast 18-inch circle around the whipping tip. The lure went nowhere. This sucked. He was sure he had done the calculations right. The weight should have pulled line out and gone approximately 30 yards in a rising 20-degree arc over the plane of the water's surface. "Try it again," his father said. "This time get ready for your cast by hooking and holding the line with your index finger, then throwing the bail." Vince nodded. He considered tossing the whole rod into the lake. He could probably get away with it. His father wouldn't know it wasn't just a stupid kid's accident. Instead, he opened the chrome wire covering the face of the spin caster. It rotated out and clicked into place. The gold and fluorescent lure dropped to the punt bottom again. His father chuckled. Vince's face warmed. He avoided his father's gaze. Instead, he looked away off across the misty pond. Cold, wet air filled his nostrils with the smell of algae, muck banks, and the surrounding forest. This wasn't his world. It was all wrong. He sniffed and blinked back tears. He'd made the same mistake twice. "I'm sorry, son. I should have said to pull your finger in tight, like this." His father reached up and wrapped a large, calloused hand around Vince's small, pale hand. He positioned Vince's hand and finger, like you're squeezing a trigger, so the line doesn't fall away. Vince reeled in his line. He pulled his finger tight against the line. He threw the bail again. "We need to get out together more," his father said. "Too much time in those math books makes you forget how to explore possibilities. If everything is by the numbers, all formulas and figures, physics and calculations, you start thinking you have to have a right answer every time. It's just not true, son. Some things don't have right answers. Some things you just have to feel to really understand." Vince set the tip of the rod back. He flipped it forward. He pointed his finger at his target. The line released, and the lure arced out over the lake. He said, 20 degrees, 3 meters of rise, 60 meters of travel. The lure splashed down. "Perfect," his father said. "That was perfect. You've been practicing." Conservation of angular momentum, augmented by the spring loading of the fiberglass tip resulting from the momentum. The lure weighs 2.5 ounces, according to the package. The tensile strength of the line is 8 pounds. The thickness is negligible. Elasticity is maybe 3% over 3 meters. The coil friction in unwinding is a primary variable in achieving distance and must be weighed in a function against the acceleration imparted by unloading the fiberglass spring. His father stared at him, his olive-green cap high on his forehead. "What?" "Formulas and figures, Dad. A right answer." "Uh-huh," his father recovered a bit. "Maybe there's math for that cast, but there's no math for the brain of a fish. The rule of very large numbers, chaos theory, and I suspect a certain amount of quantum synchronicity could be applied." Vince grinned. Fishing was starting to make sense. "You're saying you can tell how to catch a fish using math?" "I'm saying that if a person really needed to, he could probably figure out where the fish are and when they would bite by knowing a lot about where the fish aren't and when they don't bite." "I have to get you away from your mother and her damn boarding schools before you're ruined," his father said. Vince was confused. He thought he'd done it right. He cranked his reel and the bail locked shut. The rod dipped and Vince jerked his arm up. "Easy, boy, take it easy. That's just the lure hitting bottom. Water's not deep here, only about 10 feet. Just reel the lure in." He nodded. He reeled. The line cut a V-shaped wake in the water. "Feel the tip bumping? That's the lure action, son. You want that. Reel too slow, the reel tip gets quiet. reel too fast and the lure spins differently. You need to get the lure to look like a fish moving along with a gimp fin. 0.5 revolutions of the crank per second. Spindle rotation is 3.5 RPS. Tip bob at 2 BPS. BPS? Vince grinned. Bobs per second. I made it up. His father actually laughed at his joke. The rod tip pulled hard. It went down almost to the water. Lift the tip, his father said. Vince lifted the tip of the rod over his head. He felt the deep drag of something heavy on the line. Okay, now reel enough to keep the line taut, but not enough to drag the fish in. How big is the fish? I don't know. Then how do I know how hard to reel? Feel it in your hands. How? Vince was frantic. He had no math for this. His numbers left him, and the line was darting to one side, the tip following. He tried to reel, but the rod bucked in his hand. He lost his grip on the crank. The V slipped sideways one way, then the other. The bent rod tip followed like it was alive. Feel that? His father asked. You have to feel the fish now. Keep the tip high. Lead him. How? Where? It's a big fish, boy. A damn big one. Vince recovered the crank. He reeled. He felt the pull of the fish, but it didn't mean anything. It was just a pull. His reel clicked. Line dragged out against the gears of the reel. I'm reeling, but the line goes out. Good. That's good. Just keep tension on the line. The line's still going out. The drag is set to let a big fish pull without breaking the line. How strong is the drag? I don't know. Vince didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. There were too many variables, too many possibilities. If he lost a big fish, his father would laugh at him. He couldn't lose the fish. Couldn't. The fish darted left hard. Keep him out of the logs, his father called. He pulled on the oars. Vince almost fell. He lifted the tip to the right as high as he could. His mind raced. He wanted to see the fish, to know what he had hooked. The answer came to him in a blinding flash, a white-hot thought born of the need to see his father's smile. It wasn't Newtonian at all. It was a probability alignment problem. Quantum geometry. He had to force the correct configuration of line, rod tension, and fish movement. He might be able to create a synchronous probability point and access universal potentials. He led the fish with the rod tip. He didn't have time to crunch the numbers. A perfectly correct answer would take years and computers he didn't have. He had to approximate, to find the configuration. Odds were stacked badly against him. The dark energy rip expansion death of the universe had better numbers than him landing this fish. He had to try. Feel it, his father yelled. Of course, he thought. His father understood fishing, could feel it. So could he. The rod's tip dipped. The fish turned. The boat twisted. The line made a sound like a piano wire breaking. A universe Vince did not want to live in was about to be spawned by his failure. Vince's mind raced, searching for the feel of the thing, the way of it, the moment of solution. He found it in a white, hot flash of understanding, and the sound of the loon bird stopped. The tiny lapping of waves against the side of the boat went silent. He and his father stood on the still deck of the punt. The line went out from the tip of the rod to the surface of the water. Tendrils of motionless mist hovered in the silent air. Breeze-driven ripples stood in long wave lines, motionless, even where interference effects canceled or amplified the intersecting waveforms. 50 feet from the boat, a large-mouthed bass hung in the air, frozen, surrounded by motionless water spray and refraction rainbows. What the hell? His father said. Hold this, Vince said. He handed his father the rod. Keep the line tight. Don't let the rod tip dip. His father's mouth gaped. Still, he nodded and took the rod. Vince stepped out of the boat and walked across the surface of the lake to the fish. He carefully unhooked the bass, then walked back to the boat. He put the bass in the 5-gallon paint bucket they had brought for their catch. Okay, he said, give me the rod. Silent, eyes wide, his father gave the rod back. Vince gave the reel a sharp crank. The rod tip snapped forward. The line streaked up out of the water, slicing a line of spray across the surface of the lake. The lure shot back toward the boat, a steaming, red-hot streak. It hooked his father's cap and dragged it right across the boat and into the lake. Hat, lure, and lake boiled and steamed. "What in Sam Hill?" His father put a hand to his bare head. "Sorry, Dad." Vince reeled in the cap. "Holy Mary and Joseph," his father said. Vince unhooked the warm, wet hat and handed it to his father. The mist twisted. The ripples rolled. The weird bird called out across the empty lake. He'd done it. Vince inhaled a lungful of the fresh lake air. He'd caught his first fish, and his father seemed impressed. Finally, he looked in the bucket at his fish. It was a big one, maybe 6 pounds. The fish thrashed its tail and splashed water up out of the bucket. "You got it," his father said. "It's real." "Did I do it right?" Vince asked. "You walked out there and got the fish," his father pointed out over the water. "I did okay?" "How?" "I didn't do it right." "What did you do?" "Are you mad at me?" Vince's father dropped his oars and let them float free in their oar locks. He twisted his cap to get the water out. He put the wet hat back on his head. "No, Vince, I'm not mad. I just don't understand what you did. It all happened so fast. The sun must have gotten to me. I could have sworn you walked out on the water and picked up the fish. Hell, it looked like the fish just waited in mid-jump for you to come and get it." "I was afraid it would get away," Vince said. "So you walked out and got it." Vince nodded, embarrassed that he hadn't done what his father had wanted. "How was I supposed to do it?" His father looked at the fish in the bucket. Then he looked at his son. "Boy," he said, "you did it exactly the way you were supposed to. I just didn't know you had it in you. I've never been more impressed by anyone or anything in my whole life." Shocked, Vince looked at his father. "I mean, I just did what you told me. I was afraid I'd lose him. You told me just to feel it." Beaming, Vince reached in the bucket to touch his fish. "Can we let it go, Dad?" His father grinned at him and nodded. "Son, you've got a feel for it you didn't learn from your old man. And if you're willing, I'd sure love to learn it." "Sure, Dad." Vince lifted the bucket and let the bass slip back into the lake.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.